This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, sitting in for Terry Gross. Alan Rabinowitz is a New Yorker who spent the better part of the past decade in the jungles of Central America and Southeast Asia. Rabinowitz is a zoologist. His mission is to save the jaguar, the leopard, the tiger, and other endangered wildcats, and to save the rapidly disappearing forests they live in. In the mid-80s, he lived among the Mayan Indians of Belize, tracking jaguars and establishing the world's first jaguar preserve. That was the subject of his book Jaguar, which has just been published in paperback. In 1987, he was invited by the government of Thailand to study the habits of tigers and leopards so the government could assess how much of the forest would have to be preserved to sustain the cats. This work and the adventures and mishaps he had along the way are covered in his new book, Chasing the Dragon's Tail. The wildcats Rabinowitz is trying to save are the top predators in the forest. Terry asked him what would happen if these wildcats were to disappear.
There is a change, actually, and that change can be seen in the United States, where we once had pumas roaming and wolves roaming areas, and now there are too many deer which need to be culled, or they're becoming so abundant that there are problems in certain areas where people live. When you lose your top predators, the animals which they feed upon, which are usually in the case of things like tigers and jaguars and other large cats, they're mainly larger deer species, those animals start to become much more abundant because they're not under a strict control, and the weaker numbers of those species and members which were previously sickly and had parasites and would easily be taken by the larger cats as food, now they're also breeding as well as the stronger members of that species. So what you're getting actually is a weakening of the wildlife food chain when you lose your top predators, because your top predators, like the cats, serve to control all the things that come underneath it.
Now, you have an interesting technique for studying and tracking large cats. You attach little radio collars that have little transmitters on them, basically. Would you want to describe what you do there?
Okay, the animals which I study are species which have never been previously studied in these forest areas where I work. And the reason for that, which include my studies on the big cats of Thailand and the jaguars in Central America, it's all the reason that these animals have not been studied previously is because they're very secretive, solitary forest animals. And you cannot just walk in back of them and follow them or watch them or easily come upon them, even if you're tracking them in the forest. The only way to study them is a technique that's been around for quite a while now, nearly 30 years, called radio tracking, radio telemetry, where you actually capture the animal using some kind of a trap or snare, and you drug the animal, put the tiger or the jaguar to sleep, and then I attach a radio around its neck, and this radio is made as small as possible according to what the weight and the structure of the animal is. And this radio then will allow us to track the animal, to actually be following it in the forest, though I rarely ever see it again. Once I capture one of these big cats and set it free, it's very unlikely, actually, that I see it once again, because even when I'm tracking it and I try to come up very close to it, they're always one step in front of me, and they escape. They go away. So very often I'll be tracking these cats, and then I'll turn around to go back to my camp or to my field station, and I'll find that they've been tracking me. They would have circled around, and they're in back of me. So these radios will allow me to follow them without ever really seeing them again, without ever needing to see them again, though I try to, and I would very much like to see them in the forest. But it allows us to follow them, to find out exactly where they go and how much forest they use, what size forest they need. That's why this technique is so important. The reason I study large cats, which many people ask, why do I love large cats so much, or cats in general? And in actual fact, it's not the cats per se, which I love more than any other animal. It's that these large, wide-ranging predators are so important to saving the remaining tropical forest in the world, because they need more forest to roam over than any other species. But the only way to try to justify saving large areas of forest with governments, especially poor governments, is to say, well, if you truly do want to save your jaguars or your tigers, here we can show you that so many tigers need this amount of forest. And in order to find out exactly what that amount of forest is, which is usually a huge amount of area for the big cats, we need to put these radios on them and track them.
In your new book, you write that every time you capture an animal, you know, capture it so that you could just put the radio transmitter around its neck, that you have very mixed feelings. Can you describe what those mixed feelings are about?
Well, I love wildlife. I love animals. That's why I study them. Quite often, I think I love animals much more than human beings. That's why I first entered this field. So because of that, my ideal in terms of studying animals is what most people's ideal would be, and that would be simply watching them or being able to get close to them, possibly even touching them. But I don't feel good about affecting their life in any way. Now, we've done this kind of technique, radio tracking, drugging animals and putting on radios. I personally have done this for over 10 years now, and it's been done for nearly 30 years with many species of animals. So we know that if properly done, the animals are not hurt by it. But frankly, I also know that putting on radio still does affect them in some way, because I could see the change in their eyes, and I can sometimes even see the change in certain patterns of behavior when they go out. So I don't always feel good, though I know it's necessary, because there's no way we would be able to study them otherwise and get the data we need to protect them. It always saddens me when I capture something wild and free and I sort of leave my mark on it in the form of a radio collar, because then it's marked for good.
Yeah. Well, you know, to clarify, before you could put the radio collar on, you lay a trap for the cat, and then when they're trapped, you give them a tranquilizer so that you can attach the radio collar, and then you set them free. Now, early on in your work in Thailand, something went wrong with the trap, and it caused one of the cats to die.
Right. That was not a trap, though. That was a snare. That was what's called a cable snare, which actually I had very mixed feelings about using, because we know in the past there have been instances. Now, a cable snare is simply, it's sort of a modification of what hunters use in the forest. It's simply a snare set out in the underbrush. It's not something which an animal cannot see. It's set along a trail or a road where you know a big cat is walking or an animal you want to trap is walking. And when the animal steps inside of that loop which the snare is made into, the snare closes around its ankle and you capture it. Now, some animals, when they're captured, simply lie down and wait and don't fight. Some animals fight, and it tends to cause injury. In general, with the cats, we've had very mixed results using these kinds of snares very often, but more often than not, the cat, because their paws are so sensitive, that they will generally just lie down and not fight the snare. But in a few instances, they will fight and injure themselves. What I didn't expect is I got a cat. My first capture was used with a snare because we were building the large box traps and they weren't ready yet. And all I had was a snare, and we had found a big cat's kill, a tiger's kill, and wanted to try to capture that cat immediately. And I thought a lot about it, because it was a choice of either waiting till that trap was built and then just hoping that we would find a fresh kill again and be able to capture that cat, or taking advantage of the situation and going after it immediately with a cable snare, which I knew I had more than 50% chance of it coming out okay. Well, it worked against me, and it was totally my fault because I think it was a wrong choice, and I will never use a cable again. It was a big male I caught, leopard, and he fought the snare a lot. And the snare did not wrap around his ankle. It wrapped around three of his toes because as he had stepped in the snare and the snare started to close, he pulled his paw quickly upwards and it closed around three of his toes. He tugged and tugged at the cable snare because it was only 2 hours after he was caught till I reached him. And he tugged at the cable snare so much that it ripped through his skin and caused a fairly large injury to his paw. But that isn't really what killed him. What killed him was the shock and trauma of being captured in that cable snare and fighting it for more than 2 hours. And then when I got to him and I drugged him, and I saw that the injury was nasty, but it wasn't bad enough to cause the animal to die in the forest because it was an area where the animal could clean and it would heal eventually and the foot wasn't broken. But I didn't count on trauma, and trauma is something that will often kill wild animals because they're not used to being captured and kept by man. So what eventually happened is I put a radio collar on him. I didn't have a cage or a pen to keep him and watch what would occur. So I had to make a decision to radio collar him anyway and hope that everything would be okay. And I radio collared him and followed him 4 days, day and night, and he eventually died, unfortunately.
It was suggested to you that the reason why this leopard might have died was because you didn't make an offering to the mother spirit of Dancing Woman Mountain, where the preserve was. So you thought about that and ended up making an offering to her. And I was wondering what went through your mind in deciding whether you should, you know, make an offering or not. I mean, it's part of a series of beliefs and traditions that you're not really a part of, but a lot of the people who you worked with were.
That's true, especially in Thailand, especially in the forest areas. Virtually everyone there believed in spirits and ghosts. And any place that you would go in the forest where there were people that were there, they would have these little wooden spirit homes, houses for the mother or the father of the mountain. Usually it was for the mother of the mountain because the mother spirit is seen as more powerful than the male spirit, actually. So at my field station as well, there was a little spirit house for the mother. In fact, my field station was called Dancing Woman Mountain, and that was for the mother of the Dancing Mountain. Whenever anything went wrong, not just this cat dying, but anything occurring, if a man was injured or something occurred in relation to my project, they would blame it on the fact that I hadn't made the proper offerings or that I didn't truly believe in the mother of the mountain, because they felt in order to do anything in the forest that you had to ask permission of the mother. So, in fact, when this cat died, the men I worked with, the Thais, were very angry at me because they don't feel that the cat should have died and that it wouldn't have died if I had made the proper spirit offering.
So did you make the offering for the sake of the people who you work with, or did you start to believe in it yourself?
Well, at first, when the cat died, the offerings which I made were strictly for the people because they would no longer work for me unless I followed the proper protocol with the mother spirit. And as time went on, and in the course of 2 years, many strange things occurred in the forest. And to be honest with you, there were times when I wondered what was real and what was not real. Not that I came to believe in it eventually, but I came to realize that there was a lot out there I had no idea about and couldn't rationalize in scientific terms.
I think what you were supposed to give in the offering is a sign, one sign of how, you know, the modern world intrudes on the traditional world, that your offering consisted not only of pigs' heads and chickens, but whiskey and cigarettes.
That's right. Because after you make an offering to the mother of the mountain, you let the mother feed upon and smoke the cigarette and drink the whiskey or feed upon the offering for about an hour or so, and then it's okay for you to eat the food. So whenever I had to make an offering, the men made a shopping list to make sure it included a lot of the things that they really liked and couldn't afford normally either, because we would always get to feast upon it as well afterwards.
So was there a certain brand of cigarettes you were supposed to use for this offering?
Yes. Actually, when they offered it to the Mother Spirit, it would always be a very cheap brand. And when I had to make an offering, I had to go out and buy a very expensive brand of cigarettes.
Well, there you go. If you're just joining us, my guest is Alan Rabinowitz, and he's a research zoologist with Wildlife Conservation International, and he's written a new book about his work in Thailand to try to save the large cats there. It's called Chasing the Dragon's Tail. We'll take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Zoologist Alan Rabinowitz is my guest, and he's the author of the book Jaguar, about trying to save the wild jaguars in Belize. And he's also the author of a new book about trying to save the large cats in Thailand, and that's called Chasing the Dragon's Tail. For some people, this would have, like, symbolic value. You ended up getting caught in one of the traps that you had set. You were actually trying to unfasten a pig whose harness was caught on the trap, and the trap got your leg and broke a bone. What went through your mind when you were trapped by one of your own traps?
That was a strange experience for me. In the 10 years I've worked in the forest and I've trapped and radio-collared animals, that kind of incident has never occurred to me, and I've never felt that kind of fear before. One thing I'll clarify is that we use live bait in these traps because these big cats will only come in and feed upon live bait in these forest areas where their prey is normally relatively abundant. They won't take just meat or dead animals. So I would use live pigs placed in the back of these traps in order to attract the large cats, and they would then come in and trigger the trap and get caught. So every day I had to go out and feed and water these pigs as well and make sure they were okay and everything was fine with them. In this one case, it happened to be the most remote trap, the furthest from camp, and the pig was very tangled, and I was in a hurry in order to get back and eat breakfast, actually. And I did something I never normally do. I entered the trap from the front entrance instead of feeding the pig from the rear of the trap because I wanted to do it as quickly as possible. And I crawled into the trap, and I hurriedly started to untangle the pig because he had gotten tangled in the rope which attached him to the trap. And I touched and I brushed against the trigger of the trap. And I knew as soon as, in the split second I hit that trigger, I knew that the trap door was going to be coming down within a second. And that's when I had to make some kind of a decision, because I was all alone in the forest. Nobody knew exactly where I was or where this trap was except for me. And we have special locks built on top of the trap so that when the trap door closes, you cannot pick the door back up again, because we've had instances of big cats, tigers, and jaguars using their powerful jaws to open these trap doors. So when you're locked in the trap, if it's strong enough for a tiger, believe me, it's strong enough for a human being to be locked inside and not able to break out. So in the split second, I knew I was going to be trapped, and I had the fear. The only way I can describe it is the fear that must go through an animal's mind, because it was terror. It was terror of being closed in this trap and nobody knowing where I was, or it would have been pitch dark inside of the trap. And I knew I could probably dig my way out eventually, but it could have taken days if I could do it. So what I did is I threw my leg back and took the full brunt of the 40-pound door, which just came straight down. And I knew it would be painful. I didn't expect it to break my leg the way it did, but it actually snapped the bone, and it stopped the door from closing totally so that the lock for the door didn't engage. So I wasn't trapped in there, but the fear of possibly being trapped in there forced me to do what I knew would be extremely painful, and that was to throw my leg backwards and take the full brunt of that iron door on my leg, which did break. And then I had to try to get back to camp. I was about 4 miles from my camp. And I had to get back through crawling and doing several other things with a broken leg.
So did this have a lot of symbolic value to you when you got trapped by your own trap?
Well, symbolic, I'm not sure that's the word I would use. What it did is it gave me a new awareness, a new appreciation of the fear and terror that these animals must go through inside of these traps. I'm not even sure fear and terror are the right emotions, but eventually what I started doing, because I started wondering just how bad their fear and uncertainty was in these traps. So what I started doing was I hooked radio collars to the trap itself so that even if they got trapped in the middle of the night and I was sleeping, I would have a radio receiver by my bed turned on, and if the trap got closed, if they got trapped, it would pull a certain magnet off of the radio collar and turn the radio collar on, and I would know they were trapped, so I could go out and get them immediately.
You know, I can't help but wonder what keeps you going on this kind of work. You've been really seriously wounded in action several times. You've broken a leg in a trap. One of the large cats nearly bit off a hand. That's a long story, but, I mean, he was very sick, and you were trying to help him. You were speared in the foot after a motorcycle accident and had blood poisoning. You were in a plane crash. I mean, I could go on, but you certainly put yourself at risk doing this kind of work, and I would think you'd be ready to retire from it.
Well, actually, I think about that all of the time. My body tells me that I should retire soon, but my mind and my spirit tell me that there's absolutely nothing to retire to because I see no alternative. My life and my enjoyment comes from being in the wild places with the wildlife. When I get very tired and I come back to see my family in New York or I go back to the United States, it takes me no more than a week to realize that I want to be back out there in the wilder places, though it's fairly wild in New York as well.
Different kind of wild.
Yes, a more dangerous kind of wild.
Well, Alan Rabinowitz, I wish you good luck in your future work, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
Zoologist Alan Rabinowitz. He spoke with Terry Gross last November. Rabinowitz's new book about his study of the wild cats of Thailand is called Chasing the Dragon's Tail. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.